Session number 13441, reel number 1.
Air Vice Marshal Blair Oliphant, reel 1. Can you tell me first where you were born, please?
I was born in Scotland, near Blairgowrie, in Perthshire.
Which year was that, please?
1911.
What did your father do for a living?
He was, first of all, in the Army, in the Rifle Brigade, and he retired before World War I as a captain to go to Scotland and grow raspberries, which they do very successfully, or did in Perthshire, and write novels. And then, of course, World War I broke out, and he was called up, rather naturally, and was sent to Northern Ireland to raise the Royal Irish Rifles, of which he eventually commanded the 11th Battalion, and was killed, and died of wounds at the end of the war, by April 1918.
Did you go to school in Blairgowrie?
No, I went to school in England, prep school near, first of all, at Malvern. Then it moved to a place near Worcester, where it still is. And then I went to Harrow. And then I went to Cambridge.
What did you study at Cambridge?
Forestry. Very bad time to study forestry, just before the war. Not the war had anything to do with it, but there was a forestry school at Oxford, one at Cambridge, one at Bangor, one in Edinburgh, I think, all producing forestry graduates. And the jobs, of course, were worthwhile in what was then called the Empire, Indian Woods and Forests. And also at about that time, they were saying, you know, we've got our own people, we don't really want people from England. And so I think the year I graduated, there was one vacancy and there were 70 of us applied for it, and 70 more applying from the year before. So prospects in forestry. Actually, I read forestry because it interested me. I hadn't really any idea of making my career in it. One read things in those days rather this irresponsible way. It was very good, actually, but just because you're interested in them. So then I applied for... Well, I was also... My second string was Colonial Administrative Service, which is what most of the graduates of Oxford and Cambridge did in those days, went and ran the Empire. And after some months, they sent for me to the Colonial Office and said, how would you like to go and help to govern the Solomon Islands? And I said, I don't know much about them. No, they said that we've got a letter from the last chap who drew the job. And I said, why did he leave? And they said, because he didn't like it. So they gave me this correspondence, and I looked at it, and after a week I wrote and told them to keep the Solomon Islands, which I was very glad, because had I gone there, I would have been a Japanese prisoner of war very quickly. And so then, because I'd learned to fly at Cambridge, and I had both my brothers were in the army, I went into the Air Force. It seemed a natural thing to do.
I think you told me earlier that you learned to fly at Duxford.
Yes, well, that is where the Cambridge squadron operated from in those days.
What was Duxford like in those days?
Oh, it was an ordinary RAF station. I forget what squadron was there. 19 squadron, was it?
I think so.
And we were flying, learning to fly on Avro 504s.
And what about the Cambridge University Air Squadron, or whatever it was called? What was that composed of?
That was what I'm talking about.
But what kind of people were in it?
Well, it was interesting, you know, that those air squadrons were it's a very far-sighted, statesman-like decision by the government to form university air squadrons. And we wore no uniform. There were no strings. You could be pacifist. The whole object was to interest the young generation in flying. And instructors were all RAF. It was an RAF unit, and it lived at Duxford. And flying was not considered to be quite you by the universities. They didn't take to it very kindly. We weren't allowed to go solo first hello during term time. And we went for an annual attachment to Netherhaven, and there you could go solo, and then after that you could. And the then adjutant, who is now dead, became our Marshal Williams. He was then flight attendant. He did a great deal to accustom the university to the Royal Air Force and flying. But it was, you know, they looked slightly down their noses.
Did any of the Dons get involved in the air squadron?
No. It's now, of course, all the universities, or most of the universities, have got air squadrons, and for the same reason. And it always interests me. The last time I go every year to the Staff College for a sort of brief refresher, and because with everything being cut back and economised now, I ask, could we be assured that the university air squadrons will continue? And the chief of the air staff immediately said, yes, you can. So they place a lot of... But you see, they're looked at by the government. Are they cost-effective? How many people take up permanent commissions afterwards, you know, which is not the point at all. The point is still, I think, to get young people air-minded.
You said you joined the Territorial Army. Can you tell me about that?
Yes, that was while I was at Cambridge. I was living then at Much Headham in Hertfordshire, and I joined the Hertfordshire Regiment, and I was commissioned. It was the 1st Battalion, which was the only one there was, which was the Territorial Battalion, Hertfordshire Regiment. And so I had a machine gun platoon, which operated at Widford, which was just up the road from Much Headham. And, yes, I suppose... I remember I got a letter from the Air Ministry, I suppose it was, after I got, which was rather cross, because they said I couldn't have a commission both in the Army and the Air Force at the same time. So, I wasn't in the Territorial Army for very long, yeah, at all.
But you actually joined the RAF in 34?
34.
Can you tell me about that, please?
Well, I'd learnt to fly, you see, ab initio at Cambridge. I could fly with 504. And then, so my first step, I didn't have to do ab initio training. I went to Sealand, which was number 5 flying training school up near Chester, to learn to fly a service type. And this was a rather terrible aeroplane called an Atlas, made by Armstrong Whitworth. It was used for Army Corporation. So I spent nearly a year up there learning to fly this thing, which was advanced flying as it was then seen. And had one famous chap, and not on my course, on my junior course, Gus Walker. Did you ever meet Gus Walker?
No, I've never met him.
No, he was doing his flying training at the same time. And from having completed that, I went to a heart squadron at Andover.
This was 142.
142. And there we flew Hart, which were nice aeroplanes, great advance on the Atlas. And then quite quickly we got Mussolini was doing his act then. Same sort of thing that Saddam Hussein does now, or did now. Invaded Ethiopia with poison gas. And Britain's response was quite sharp. We sent 11 squadrons of the Royal Air Force overseas, all in one ship, and dropped off, I think, one in Malta and one or two in Egypt and some more down in the Sudan. And we confronted Mussolini, 142 squadron and 33, at a place that nobody had ever heard of in those days, called Mersmatru, which, of course, became famous later on. So we sat in the desert at Mersmatru for about a year, growling at Mussolini. We never engaged in operations.
Did you see anything at all of the Italians?
No, not really. We were very concerned that we could, that the Hart could fly far enough to bomb their airfields, which was quite a stretch. And we did great things to find out whether by flying at optimum height and optimum speed we could increase our range. And then we discovered quite quickly that the thing we ran out of first was not petrol but oil. because the sand in the desert was makes a very good grinding pace. And we were changing engines every 80 hours until somebody invented an air filter. And we learnt a lot, actually. That was useful in Normandy, where we had the same problem after the invasion with dust and sand. So then we came back after the crisis, I suppose it then was over, and they pulled us back to Ismailia. And a very beneficent air ministry said, we must get the squadron home by Christmas. This was 1936. And they stopped a passenger boat in the canal and moved all the passengers to one side and put the squadron in the other, and they got us home by Christmas. And we landed at Southampton, I don't know, got ashore, bought an evening paper, and the headline was Abdication. Quite a thing to come home to, because we'd heard nothing about it, of course. Even though the press was all very... We'd heard nothing about this. And you arrive home after a couple of years abroad, find your king is abdicating. It's quite... So that was 36, Christmas 36. 37, I did the armament course at East Church.
Why did you become an armament specialist?
Well, all general duties officers, flying officers, specialised in something in those days. You could specialise in engineering, navigation, armament. What else? Photography, I don't know. Anyway, you were all encouraged. In fact, more or less directed to specialise, and I was always interested in weapons, and so I plumped for armament.
What was the state of RAF armament in 1937?
What was
the state of RAF armament?
Well, it was fairly primitive. The Hart, you see, carried, what, 2 500-pound bombs? Had one machine gun? Firing forward, and a scarf ring with a Lewis gun in the rear cockpit. But you know, it's interesting, because I've often thought, looking back, we enjoyed flying, and we did bombing competitions, and there were, I never thought about what the destructive effect of these things would be, if you know. But I never thought of them in terms of warfare. And I think many of us were the same.
That seems strange, in a way.
It does seem strange. We only put live bombs on comparatively rarely. We bombed with practice bombs, little things, you know. And you did these, and the bombing competitions were important, you know, and then you went to practice camp, and you shot at drogues, and you scored. And but in terms of what destruction it would actually do to... you know, it wasn't... One didn't think in those terms. Perhaps people in the air ministry did, I don't know.
Because Britain wasn't up against it.
37, yes. The Air Force started doubling. It doubled twice between the time I joined. It was a very good time to join, promotionally. So that I was promoted to flying officer, almost. I was promoted to flight lieutenant after 18 months' service. And I remember my flight commander being really very annoyed, because he'd waited 12 years to get promoted. This was the effect of the expansion of the Air Force. And towards the end, yes, the armament course, which normally at East Church had about 10 or 12 people on it, I think we were 27, which was to match the expanding Air Force. And I remember towards the end of the course, somebody said to me, where do you want to be posted? Oh, I said, I go where I'm sent. Oh, they said, you may as well apply for somewhere. So I said, I'd like to go to Scotland. You know, oh, they said, yeah, bloody fool wants to go to Scotland anyway. So either you'll go to Montrose, which is a flying training school, or Evanton, which is an armament practice camp. I got quite used to this idea, and the air minister stepped in and posted me into an aircraft carrier in the Mediterranean. This is
the glorious.
This is the glorious. I knew nothing about the Navy. What I did know, I didn't think I liked very much. And I really enjoyed it. It was one of the best experiences of my service, I think.
Why was it so good?
Well, it was interesting. The Navy, I found great admiration for the Navy about the way they go about things. And then, of course, you see, it was good fun. You were based in Malta. We went to Gibraltar. We went to the south of France. We went to Corsica. We went to Alexandria. We went to Yugoslavia. It was a good time. And, of course, war was... It was by that time, it was fairly getting evident there was going to be a war. There was already a war going on in Spain. Franco and his chaps, that was going on. And things started... We started fusing bombs and loading, or doing quite warlike exercises and going about darkened ship. And there was quite a sense. I mean, some months before the war began. So all of that was an enjoyable experience. And then I was promoted, you see, again, squadron leader quite quickly in beginning of 39, and was posted to the air headquarters in Cairo, which was convenient as the ship was in Alexandria.
You said you liked the way in which the Navy went about things. What exactly did you mean by that?
Well, they're very businesslike, they're very real. It's easier for them. I mean, there they are at sea. You've got everything on board. Nobody is on weekend leave. If you want to have an exercise at 3 in the morning, you have it at 3 in the morning, and everybody's there. Do you know? The aircraft are never unserviceable for very long, because all the chaps had to do was to get them serviceable again. And they're a very efficient service. And I enjoyed it, and it was very helpful for my career afterwards, because one met a lot of naval officers, and I enjoyed that.
Can you tell me about life aboard Glorious? Because we were saying earlier how later on it became a rather unhappy ship.
Yes, well, it was as you probably know, historically, for years there was a great battle between the Admiralty and the as to who should control the fleet air arm. And when we were there, when we were ashore, we were under the air ministry. When we were aboard, we were under the Admiralty. And their lordships and their airships fought continuously But at the sharp end, on the ship, we were very happy. We worked together. The airmen and the sailors respected each other professionally, and it was a very efficient unit, as units went in those fighting unit. But the Navy are remarkable. I mean, in those days, all the aircraft maintenance, of course, was done by the Air Force. The Navy hadn't gotten it, air artificers in those days, and so all the maintenance. And I can't remember whether a third of the crew were, of the air crew were Navy, and a third or two thirds, and the others Air Force. But there they all. They were mixed in squadrons. But their lordships, of course, being as all the technical side was Air Force, they used Air Force manuals. And their lordships pasted in the beginning of these a little slip of paper which said, "Their lordships do not necessarily agree with anything in this book." A wonderful attitude, isn't it? Not necessarily agree.
How much of the happiness in the ship was due to the captain?
A great deal. He was a very excellent man. Actually, just while I was serving with her, and in that picture, we had we disembarked some swordfish at Decatur, which was the civil airport for Alexandria. And we had a tented camp there, and I was made adjutant of this thing, I think largely because as an Air Force officer, they knew I'd be in touch with the Air Force depot at Aboukir. And I had to write the standing orders for this camp, which I did in strictly terrestrial terms. I referred to the what did they used to call them, liberty lorries, if you were going ashore, and of course the heads, which were the lavatories, and so with my tongue in my cheek, I wrote all the camp standing orders in strictly terrestrial terms, and we flew, of course, the Air Force ensign. And while we were actually there, the thing changed, the Navy. Navy control didn't make much of a difference, you know, but it was. And so we had these few swordfish embarked, disembarked there in order to do anti-submarine patrols. And there was very nearly a mutiny there, because for the Air Force, living on board an aircraft carrier is not much fun for the other ranks. They sleep in hammocks, which the Air Force is not used to doing. The sergeant's mess was a place not very much bigger than twice the size of this room, with no beer. So it wasn't much fun for the other ranks. What really precipitated nearly a mutiny was when we disembarked and were living under canvas at Decatur, that the Navy drew hard-lying money. But these sort of things, there was no hard feeling. Do you remember the sailors and the airmen got on very well together.
But the other RAF other ranks were discontented with the living conditions.
Well, they put up with it, as people do. But discontent never. But when they found they came ashore and found the Navy were getting hard lying money for living in tents, it was quite difficult to take.
Was there any hint in 1938-39 in the Glorious that it would ever come to a bad end?
Oh no, she was a happy ship. I mean, you don't think about the next commission; you only know the one you're in.
You told me that you had correspondence with John Winton about the ship.
Hmm.
What kind of information were you able to give him about your?
Much what I'm telling you now. He first of all just wrote and said, you know, I noticed you were there. Would you like to write any reminiscences? And I wrote him 2 or 3 pages. Oh, he said, this is so interesting. It's what I wanted. He said, now would you answer some questions? And the questions were largely on RAF Navy relations, which is what he wanted to know. And I showed him how good they were. Particularly, I mean, the air crews, they very much respected each other, professional ability. And I told a story which is in his book. I mean, between the sailors and the airmen, there was a lot of ribbing. And usually it was over naval terms. And there was a delightful occasion when they were lowering some piece of equipment in a hangar. And an airman said provocatively, "Lower away beautifully." So the sailor said, "Not beautifully, it's handsomely." The airman said, "I knew it was something fucking lovely." this was the sort of, you know, because the Navy do have, I mean, very much their own way of doing it, everything, and their vocabulary is very naval too. I enjoyed it very much. I value the Navy.
Were you inglorious when war was declared?
No. I was in headquarters in Cairo, Air Force headquarters. And of course, we didn't declare war, or rather, war wasn't declared on us until June 1940 against the Italians. War began against Germany in September 39, didn't it?
Yes.
And we were out there, and the Italians declared war on us, having made an axis with Hitler. And that was an amusing thing there, because we were learning, you know, we had squadrons out in the desert, and the army had their troops out in the desert. And we hadn't learnt in those days that it was a good thing to have the army and the Air Force headquarters in the same place. You know, we were still very separate in our outlooks. And the news of the Italian declaration of war was received over civil radio. One heard on civil radio that the Italians had declared war on us. And there was the Air Force commander in the desert was a famous man called Collishaw. He was a Canadian First World War pilot, and he was commanding the Air Force out there. And the general, I forget which general it would have been then, O'Connor, maybe, I'm not sure, commanding the army troops, rang Collishaw up and said, "I say, you know, Collishaw, have you heard the news?" Which was the Italians declaring war. And Collishaw said, "Yes, I have." And the general said, "Well, shouldn't we fly a reconnaissance or something?" Colin Shaw said, reconnaissance, he said, bomb the buggers, that's what I'm going to do. And he did.
Were you present when that happened?
No, I was in Cairo. And then gradually, of course, there was a great deal to learn of army cooperation. It went right on into the Second War.
What type of things needed learning at that
Well, just that they understood each other. I mean, the army wanted to use the Air Force as forward artillery, you know. The Air Force was concerned to establish air superiority so that the other Air Force didn't, you know. It was a different outlook. Very parochial one, understandably. And gradually we learned to get on together and became very good. Because by the end, by the time the Germans came in there and into North Africa, Tedder was commander-in-chief in Cairo then. Cunningham, the New Zealander, was commanding the Air Force. And it was he who worked out very largely all this business of Army Air Force cooperation, and he commanded in the Air Force in the invasion too, you see, right to the end of the war, Second Tactical Air Force.
There ever at this stage of the war any bad relations between RAF personnel and Army personnel, as developed at the time of Dunkirk in Europe?
No, I didn't. Not bad relations, no. I mean, one's always critical of what the other people are. Look what they're doing now. No, it went very well. It went very well.
But you were at the headquarters.
I was in Cairo. Yes.
At the time when Wavell's attack took place.
That's right.
Counterattack.
Yes.
Yes.
I left there. When did I leave? Just before Christmas. 1940, I suppose. About the time when Rommel was approaching Alexandria. Got quite close.
What kind of?
Just before Alamein, in fact.
What kind of duties did you have at the HQ?
Well, I was command armament officer. I was responsible for the weaponry and all the aircraft. We had an interesting incident just before the war. We started after September 1939. The squadrons there, bomber squadrons, I think one, two, were re-equipping with Blenheims. Most advanced bomber there was at the time, and our government had promised some Blenheims, indeed sold them, I think, to Turkey. And people weren't quite sure which side of the war Turkey was coming in on. So they said, look, yes, that's right. And so, as a sweetener, I suppose, they instructed us to send Blenheims from our squadrons to Turkey. That wasn't a very popular decision, as you can imagine. These squadrons being equipped with this beautiful brand new aircraft were then told to take them and deliver them to the Turks. And as a sweetener, I suppose, they instructed us to send Blenheims from our squadrons to Turkey. That wasn't a very popular decision, as you can imagine. These squadrons being equipped with this beautiful brand new aircraft were then told to take them and deliver them to the Turks. And I remember on the outbreak of war, the very day, was it the 3rd of September? I was sitting in my office and I received a signal from the Air Ministry which said, believe it or not, please confirm that the bomb sites supplied to Turkey were recalibrated in kilometres and Turkish. I thought of all sorts of answers I might send. I didn't send any.